Welcome to Education Conversations, where we share ideas on education today and ways to help prepare students to thrive. We want to thank Suncoast Credit Union for sponsoring this podcast and for all you do to support education. Today, Education Foundation's President and CEO Jennifer Vine is joined by a guest from Florida Policy Institute, or FPI, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing policies and budgets that improve the economic mobility and quality of life for all Floridians. Noreen Dollard is the Senior Policy Analyst and Director of Kids Count. FPI is the Florida partner of this national network dedicated to tracking the well-being of children across the country. While FPI focuses on many areas of research and policy, one area that is of interest to us is, of course, education. In today's episode, Unpacking Florida's Scholarship Boom and Its Consequences, we will explore school vouchers, where we were, where we are today, and the impact on public education.
Noreen, I am so excited to have you here today. It's always a pleasure to have the Florida Policy Institute be a part of these conversations. You guys are just rigorous and steadfast and incredibly knowledgeable. And I think having you here as our guest today is going to just be enormously helpful to us. So welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me and for such kind words. We do our very best to put out credible research to inform what's going on. And for me, particularly, education and early learning are my passion and my work.
So it was great when Holly was with us in season one, Holly Bullard, and she's also just a phenomenal resource for us. And she made reference to the time about the Great Recession and how we really, in the space of education, hadn't really fully rebounded, particularly in terms of the base student allocations and even educational savings accounts, as we're kind of looking at kind of the shape and the expansion of student scholarships and vouchers. So I don't know, what have you seen and anything you can add to that conversation that kind of backfilled from when Holly was with us in season one and where we are now?
In terms of the base student allocation when adjusted for inflation, we still have not recouped the levels that were allocated before the Great Recession. We tend to be low ranked in per pupil expenditure. I think we're at 44th. Nationwide, according to the National Education Association. So we definitely have room for growth there.
So when you reference that, you're speaking about Florida as a state, and then kind of even looking pre-Great Recession, post-Great Recession. And can you just share with the listeners, why is that base student allocation, when we reference that as kind of like the baseline for funding into the local school districts, why does that matter so much? Can you just add a little color to that?
Sure. The base student allocation is really the building block for the state's, it's called the Florida Education Finance Program, and it is a funding formula that, when it was initiated in the 70s, was really pretty remarkable, because the intent was really to ensure that there would be equitable funding across Florida, which, of course, is a very diverse state. So you start with a base student allocation, and then there are various adjustments that consider whether it's a large district or a small district. Are the students served? You know, what grade levels are they? Do they have disability that needs to be accommodated? So putting together all of those different considerations, you start with the base student allocation, and then you add to it, and then you add local revenue, and then you come out with the per pupil funding.
That is a great explanation. And the scholarships and vouchers have been around for a while, but the Florida Empowerment Scholarship has really skyrocketed, particularly in the past couple of years. So how does that impact the base student allocation? How does that impact the full funding for that FEFP that you were just describing?
For the Family Empowerment Scholarships, they are funded at the exact same amount that school districts are funded. This year, it's almost $9,000 on average. It varies, of course, with the district, but it's funded at the exact same level. really the use of the word scholarship is not preferred because we want to call them vouchers. That's what it is. People don't earn these scholarships. So I won't probably use that word again. So the per pupil funding that Sarasota County gets for Johnny who goes to PS 101 is the same as, you know, Susie who goes to a private school or is a homeschooled student.
Right. And so what kind of deleterious impact has this had on the state of Florida for the public schools? So looking at their perspective, how has this negatively impacted the public schools? And if you have any local information that might even kind of tie back to, you know, the impact it's had for us in Sarasota.
In 2023, what was then called HB 1, House Bill 1, expanded eligibility. It removed any income eligibility requirements. So they're considered universal vouchers. As I said, for the Family Empowerment Scholarship, those come directly out of general revenue for education. This year, statewide, they account for 24% of the entire Florida Education Finance Program, which is where the per pupil is calculated from. So it's increased like 21% just this last year. In Sarasota, the numbers keep going up. In 2021, so before the expansion, $13.3 million were being spent in Sarasota schools on vouchers, so coming effectively out of their budgets. This year, it's more than $45 million. And the effect that it has, it takes the money from public schools, diverts it to private schools and homeschool students who don't have the same cost structures as public schools do. Public schools, you know, they have a year-long budget process. So money that is for transportation, money that's for teacher salaries, all that part of the per pupil funding is going to private schools, is going to homeschoolers who don't need transportation or teacher salary increases. So it takes away from the public schools. It impacts what, you know, their fixed costs. It's like you have to air condition rooms in Florida, whether there's 10 students in them or there's 20.
Right.
So those kinds of fixed costs take time to account for in the budgeting process.
I know I've heard Superintendent Connor here locally speak about how even they're having to really address some of their budget concerns and constraints that have been various factors. Certainly, there's just generally lower enrollment numbers, even because families are having less children, but they are seeing a decline and a shift from public into more students accessing this, and the costs are rising. So I think to your point, whether it's deferred maintenance, you know, roofing costs, utility, capital costs, those are long-term investments school districts make. And for them to be able to respond on a dime does seem difficult. I want to go to the next point of that. When I think you were just starting to touch on this, when you were comparing kind of the difference between some of the public and the private schools, is in terms of like the accountability, because that often comes up in conversations when you hear people advocating for or against this, but the measure of how the schools are being held accountable that are receiving the funds. Is that something the Florida Policy Institute is tracking, is advocating for, anything in that space?
Definitely. We've been advocating for increasing accountability and transparency since it went to universal vouchers, because there's virtually no accountability either in what the funds are being expended for, how they're being dispersed. The data they used to publish on the Family Empowerment Scholarship or the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship, there used to be quarterly reports on demographics and the schools that were registered. And those reports are no longer publicly available. They stopped publishing them. The data I've gotten has been through record requests or from Step Up for Students, which is what we call in Florida a scholarship funding organization that actually administers the voucher program. They get the money from the Department of Education and they get it into the hands of schools or parents, depending on what kind of voucher that the student is receiving.
So what data are you seeing on that? Are you seeing anything in terms of the demographics of a larger percentage of a certain gender or race or socioeconomic status is accessing? Are you seeing any of those things that you can, you know, speak to, or is that hard to discern through the limited information?
The demographics, they do have more students of color than are in the general population. Something that did change with the universal vouchers as they came out, before that bill passed, there were income limits. You know, most families were either at 95% of the federal poverty, which is a tier in the income eligibility. I mean, to this day, mm-hmm. I don't know that it matters if it's universal, but they do ask for that information and consider that information. And then families who are getting up to 400% of the federal poverty level, which was a cap, there were some that were over that, which is $120,000, $125,000 a year for family of four. So it was already fairly generous mm-hmm. Before it went private. But you can see that new students, there is definitely a shift to the more affluent families, as you would expect.
Can I ask, when you say as you would expect, why would you expect that?
I would expect that because new applicants come from people who are already in private schools. And that's a phenomenon you see in other states like Arizona, where there are universal vouchers. Essentially, it's free money. It's not taxable income. If you're already sending your kid to private school, then, you know, your accountant would tell you, take the money.
Right. Okay.
So that's why I would say as you would expect. And so it really is subsidizing wealthy families to a large degree.
Does that mean out of the total allotment of dollars available to support the education of public school students in the state of Florida, 25% are now flowing out to and through scholarships and vouchers? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
For the Family Empowerment Scholarship, which is general revenue.
Okay. That's actually really helpful information. And so how is the Florida Policy Institute kind of forecasting then over the next 3 to 5 years? Where are we going to see that percentage potentially creep up to?
In terms of anticipated growth mm-hmm. in the voucher mm-hmm. program, the Office of Economic and Demographic Research, which is the research arm of our legislature, predicts that by 2029, 2030, that there will be nearly 700,000 students receiving vouchers. Now, that's not just family empowerment. It's also a Florida tax credit. It's a significant increase because right now we're at 429,000 is what the current projection is for the FES.
Okay, so near almost double, maybe an 85. I'm swagging here, people. Don't hold me to my math, but 85% maybe. But that number, what is the percentage of that 400 some odd thousand, and then you're forecasting potentially 700,000 students? How many students actually are in Florida? So we can put that in perspective.
Yeah, right now there's, I think it's 2.7 million students.
Okay.
And that includes traditional students. It includes charter schools, which are public schools, as well as different voucher programs.
Okay.
Including PEP, which is what
yes.
the homeschool program is called, as well as the private school vouchers.
Okay. That's also super helpful. So it's, you're kind of forecasting that over 30% of the students in Florida would be accessing the scholarships and vouchers. Okay, that is, and listeners, again, pardon the math. I mean, this was rough math. This was not an exact science on the math, but I think you're illustrating a very solid point. So that brings me to my next question. You know, in 1973, I think it was in the 70s, when the Florida Education Finance Program, that innovative model, not so innovative anymore, it seems. Is there any movement on that being adjusted so that the schools are not just always crying, not just crying foul, because I'm not sure they're all crying foul. Many are actually supportive of school choice and everything. So I'm not saying that, but in terms of the financial loss, period, that's all I'm suggesting. Do you see any opportunity there?
What the Senate attempted to do in making a line item was to take it out of the calculation of per pupil, but it was still being paid for from the Florida Education Finance Program. So whether it's within the calculation or it's outside the calculation, it's still diverting public dollars to private schools. So maybe it doesn't directly affect the school districts, but overall, it is a loss to Florida's public education system.
Okay. Thank you for that delineation. That's helpful. So just kind of flipping it then, and let's try to, and I know this whole conversation really has been about the impact, the financial impact that districts are feeling, but let's take the finance and the money away off the table for just a minute. Are you seeing any bright spots with having the expansion of school choice with the availability and accessibility of scholarships and vouchers? Is it helping any students?
I am sure there are individuals that would report they are benefiting from this. And according to Step Up for Students, one of their recent reports was looking at the reasons why students who were awarded vouchers didn't take them. There are definitely folks who are nervous to take them. There was a large percent that said they didn't use it because they were afraid that there would be costs that they would be responsible for the private school that the vouchers don't cover. And the vouchers do not guarantee full coverage for tuition. If you're going to one of the more high-end private schools, you know, you can pay $20,000 in tuition, and vouchers are not going to cover that. Even more modest places, it might not cover all the tuition. It might not cover, you know, books and uniforms and whatnot. What I think, it does not benefit Florida's children in general, because it diminishes our abilities to support our public school students, which Floridians really value. I know where I'm from in Hillsborough County, we just voted to tax ourselves for schools. And I think the same is true in Sarasota. Mm-hmm. And last fall, it was true in 11 counties, voted to tax themselves because they thought public education was worth it. The other groups that concern me are students with disabilities who, once they take a voucher, are no longer guaranteed their right to a free and appropriate education. I mean, that's education law, and that's their protection. I'm saying public schools are perfect and everybody gets a... We certainly have work to do, but I think the public schools are better positioned. Their staff are qualified. When we invest in public schools, we know what we're getting because they, you know, have outcome measures. You know, they're held to standards, whether it's a building, whether it's teacher certification. So that sort of quality is baked into the public education system. And those requirements are not true of private schools. Are there accredited private schools? For sure. But many of the schools that take vouchers are not accredited.
Yes, I think you're helping our listeners. Certainly, you've kind of covered some of the landscape, if you will, that is beyond the financial. I think you made some comments that are more on like the philosophical approach of how are Americans viewing public education and how is that dynamic at odds, you know, within our own communities. I think you're touching on that a little bit. And I think you also raised a great point, though, of making sure that as families are able to make choices, that they make informed choices, because I do think some of the points that you made regarding certainly students with disabilities, you know, there are federal guidelines and mandates and accountability levels for which public schools have long been held accountable for and have done an extraordinary job of working towards supporting the individual learning plans that students need. I did not say perfect. Just for all those listeners out there that may have had a not so positive experience, but I do think it's been an extraordinary effort for sure. So this has been really helpful, Noreen. I'm so glad you came on our podcast today. There's so much more to talk about because I think this is going to be something that stays with us. It's proven, it sticks. And so how we wrestle through all of this, I think having people like you at the table and sharing your information is just really helpful so that we can all come together. Is there any aspect in this conversation that you felt I missed or didn't hit upon that you want to add?
I would like to say something about the moniker school choice. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the buzz that, you know, parents are making choices. Well, in fact, when it comes to a private school, parents don't make choices. Schools make choices. And, you know, if your child isn't eligible to attend that school, all the money in the world isn't going to get you in the door. So I disagree with that particular terminology. The other thing I think that I would add is that there's some belief that if you pay for it, you get a better quality product. You know, I pay more for my Mercedes than my Ford, then, you know, I'm getting a better car. And people had that same perception, I think, about, well, if I'm paying a school, my kid's going to get a better education. And, well, in point of fact, we're all paying for public schools. Public schools are a public good. We invest in our communities. They contribute to our economies. So we are already paying for public schools. There isn't any reason to have to pay private schools to educate our children well.
Well, thank you so much, Noreen, for having that final comment in this really informative podcast. Again, thank you for being a part of this. And like I said, I think this is a conversation we're going to continue to have for quite some time. So I just want to thank you all so much for listening in to today's podcast. And Noreen, thank you again for sharing your insights and findings with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight.
So listeners, if you want to learn more about the Florida Policy Institute, which I would certainly encourage you to check them out, you can find them on the website at floridapolicy.org. And as always, you can visit us at our website, edfoundationsrq.org. You can always find all of our episodes wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to let us know. And a big thanks again to our sponsor. We love Suncoast Credit Union. You just are really terrific supporters for us. And thank you all for tuning in to today's episode of Education Conversations.